Welcome, everyone. Good to see you all. I've been out of town for a week, and it's very good to be back. Traveling is tiring. I was at the Great Vow Zen Monastery in Portland at a Tibetan Dzogchen Great Perfection Retreat. And they have, this Zen Monastery is doing 4 different Dzogchen retreats with different teachers this year. So there seems to be some kind of coming together of these particular traditions in America these days among some people. So it was nice to see old friends and receive new teachings. And tonight I'd like to bring up the topic. I think the last time I spoke here, the topic was making offerings to Buddhas. And this is a topic that can't be exhausted, but I thought at least another week, another talk, exploring this practice of making offerings to Buddhas. We've talked about Buddha before, but many things can be said, and none of them reach what Buddha is, actually. But for now, we could say the boundless awareness that's present here and now for each of us. We could say the totality of everything in the universe. Those might sound different, but I think not really. We could say the all-inclusive presence, timeless presence of all beings. So we might ask, well, why would we want to make offerings to that Buddha? And one way we could look at it is, it's just because we think that there's all these things that don't already belong to Buddha. If we think of Buddha as the totality of everything, then already everything's already given to Buddha. But we often forget that. We think like, well, I have this thing. It's actually not Buddha's. It's mine. And they have that thing, and that's not Buddha's. That's theirs. And this is just our normal human way of thinking. So to kind of like retrain our minds back to the reality that everything is already Buddha's, we can practice making offerings to Buddhas. And we can look at this as, usually we think of offerings as kind of outer offerings, things of the world outside of us. Like in the Zendo here, we offer candlelight and incense and flowers and water and so on. And that's how the tradition does it. These outer, beautiful and simple objects from ancient times have been offered to Buddhas, kind of symbolizing everything else too. Everything beautiful and enjoyable we offer to Buddhas. Because again, we might think that, well, this is my enjoyment. And that's what's so great about it. It's my enjoyment. But then if we give that enjoyment to the Buddhas, it becomes even more enjoyable. Because it's not just mine anymore. So we can enact this in practical ways. And Jean and Nettie recently had an altar making workshop, and some people here built some altars, and I just want to offer that, maybe even recommendation, in this year of studying and practicing devotion. If you don't already have one, you could set up in your home in some sacred place that's not like full of clutter of other things, set up an altar with a Buddha on it. And since the Buddha is the totality of everything, it could look like anything. Traditionally, we depict it as like the human Buddha. Something to remind us of boundless, all-inclusive awareness, timeless and present and free. And the altar could just be, you know, a space on a shelf, but someplace set aside and generally kind of raised up. Not like right on the floor where we might kick it over or something. And then at that place, the main thing of the altar is the reminder of Buddha, but then it's a place to make these offerings. We could say it's symbolic, but it's this nice reminder, especially at times when we feel like, I feel separate from Buddha, I feel like the things I have are separate from Buddha, then we can offer them to Buddha. And Buddha very graciously doesn't kind of like snatch them away and said, you can't enjoy them anymore. Buddha lets us still enjoy them too. But there's a kind of feeling in making an offering like this. You have to do it with a kind of genuine sincerity to have it, to enjoy the full effect of making offerings to Buddhas. And as I mentioned, the traditional ones are candle light or electric light, incense or some kind of fragrance, flowers, physical beauty, water and food. So all the senses, the five physical senses, we offer enjoyable things of the five senses to the Buddhas, because that's basically how we enjoy the world. So you can, before a meal, you can offer some of your food to Buddha. Even if you don't have an altar, or you're out somewhere, not around an altar, when you take a bite of food, you can actually like give the first bite to Buddha. I try to do this sometimes, and it's very easy to forget, because it's just like time to eat. But I think it's a nice practice. You can even imagine like Buddha is like in your heart, or on top of your head, And the first bite, as you start to enjoy it, I offer this to Buddha, and I'm enjoying this flavor, and this part is for Buddha. You can take everything from this first bite, Buddha, and then we can continue to eat. And we could do it with every bite, but that's maybe gets tedious. And if somebody gives you something, these are all kind of traditional practices. If somebody gives you a gift, something small enough to fit on the altar, you can first offer it to Buddha and just, you know, leave it there for a day or something before you even open it. It's kind of like, well, it's really Buddha's to begin with. And then I can enjoy it too. And it's basically anything that we have any attachment to. And it might be like, well, I'm not necessarily attached to the first bite of food, but, you know, a little bit. Anything that I'm really enjoying as my own, kind of in a separate way, those are nice things to offer. So Dogen Zenji, or ancient founder in the Bodhisattva's Methods of Guidance, says, giving means non-greed. So could say making an offering to Buddha is just not greedily holding our own things. And Dogen goes on, even if the gift is not your own, there's no reason to abstain from giving it. So that's a kind of provocative statement. You can give other people's stuff. And part of the principle here from ancient times, it said that physically manifested offerings, like an actual candle and flowers, and mentally created offerings are no different in value, actually. The physical ones are just, they remind us more, and they might test us a little more. Like, I can imagine giving my car to Buddha or something, But then, like, to really give my, I don't know, put my car on the altar or something, has a different feeling. So the physical kind of, like, helps us get into the feeling of it. But really, if we do it sincerely, in either case, it's the same mentally created offerings. And this is because this is the Dharma principle that everything that appears to us in physical form is created by mind, basically. Even in the early schools of Buddhism, like in Abhidharma, it said karma, or the intentional activities of humans, create the entire world. That's a big topic in itself, of course, but the more we open to that, the more we can see that, oh, it really is like my intention behind things is the root of everything that happens. In order to actually offer physical flowers, we have to intend to make some effort to gather them. And but if we like imagine offering the flowers, it can be the same. And the nice thing about imagined, mentally created offerings is you can get even more into it than, say, you know, flowers. You could gather like a pretty big vase, but there's no limit, right, to imagined flowers. Like, not just like acres of fields of flowers of all colors, but whole like planets full of just like flowers bigger than we can imagine, and whole universes full of flowers like swirling through the air and raining down upon all the Buddhas. We can imagine such a thing with great joyful feeling, and I give everything that I can imagine. Basically, I give my imagination to all the Buddhas. And I think if we try this, there's a kind of lightness that comes. We start to feel more and more joyful, even just imagining it, if it's done sincerely. So those are all the outer offerings, and those are the ones you can actually physically enact at a home altar as a kind of reminder. And then another type of offering I've been exploring is called maybe more like inner offering of our own body and mind. We could say that actually all these mentally created images are created by our own body and mind too, so they're actually, in the end, they're also inner offerings. But to look at it like specifically our own body and mind, and we can kind of go through it. The Buddhist tradition kind of has this setup of like there's these five physical senses and five aggregates. And I've been trying to practice with this some enjoying it when I do. So kind of like one by one. This could be like during zazen or any time walking down the street. Maybe walking down the street could be better sometimes, because you could start with like the eye, your own eyes. I offer my eyes to all the Buddhas in the 10 directions. Like really sincerely, like I give them to you, Buddha. Do what you will with them. And then for them to be received, that means the Buddhas have to actually like inhabit them. The Buddhas can say, no, I don't want your eyes, but they're too compassionate to do that. They always want to receive our offerings. So for the Buddhas to receive our eyes, they have to come in and inhabit our eyes. And then Buddhas looking through our eyes, right? That's how I would understand offering my eyes to Buddha, is letting Buddha inhabit my eyes. What a great thing, right? It sounds a little scary at first, like if I offer my eyes to Buddha, he might like trash them or something. But Buddhas aren't like that, right? They just like, they can just come in. Remember now, Buddha is the boundless totality of everything. Can come in now, if we offer them, and instead of saying, these are my eyes, okay, Buddha. They're not part of the they're part of the totality of everything, but they aren't actually the totality of everything. Or I don't give them to the totality of everything. But if we do, then you could see the totality of everything, then start seeing through our eyes. And then I, as an individual person, am not exactly in control anymore of what I'm seeing. Like Buddha gets to decide. So it's kind of like giving the power over to Buddha. It's another way of looking at making these inner offerings. So you could walk down the street and see beautiful trees and flowers, and you could offer those beautiful trees and flowers as the external objects, but also these eyes that are enjoying them right now, I give them to Buddha too. And the ears, not just the external sounds, but I give these ears to Buddha so I can let Buddha now inhabit this person's ears. Now Buddha can hear through these ears. I give this nose, I offer this nose to all Buddhas. Let Buddha come and inhabit this nose. I offer this tongue to all Buddhas. So therefore, when any delicious flavors touch the tongue, Buddha tastes them. Buddha might enjoy them and respond to these flavors differently than I do. And the body sensation itself, the tactile sensations of the body, I offer to the Buddha. So we generally want to offer the best. And so sometimes when I'm trying out this meditation, I may be not feeling so like physically comfortable. I offer Buddha this body, but like, this isn't like, I'm kind of like, there's some tension here now. I'm like, that's okay, we can offer that too. But to make an even like more wonderful, wholehearted gift, let me relax first and feel the ease of a relaxed body and then offer that. Or both. Nice thing about Buddhas too is they don't discriminate between like a tense body and a relaxed body. But still, we want to offer the best, especially anything that we're holding on to. Sometimes we might be holding on to actually a tense body. We can give that to Buddha. Sometimes we might be holding on to a really relaxed body. We can give that to Buddha. So that's the five physical senses, and then the five aggregates that make up the person. Form is those five senses. We call form is the five physical senses. So we've covered that. The next one is feeling. So again, we might say, well, shouldn't we just offer our pleasant feelings to Buddhas? All feelings we can offer to Buddhas, but especially if we have a particularly pleasurable feeling. This is very hard to do, right? To remember at this very time, instead of just enjoying it, I offer to the Buddhas. Maybe easier to do with neutral feelings. But it's a kind of mind training I'm appreciating. But also not, you know, I've been sick for a while myself, so this there's a lot of unpleasant feelings in this body, and I offer them to the Buddhas too. So Buddha, the totality of everything, can inhabit every feeling. And then the third aggregate after form and feelings is perceptions or conceptions. And here we might like say like thought, the way we like label things and name things and think things. I could offer all my thoughts to the Buddha, good and bad ones. But since I appreciate Buddha so much, if I'm doing that practice of offering my presently arising thoughts to Buddhas, I might feel like these thoughts are like Buddha's I love Buddha so much that these thoughts are like a little bit like, I feel like they're not the best offering I can make. So then I might like try to transform the thought a little bit to offer a so-called better one. Again, I think not so nice ones are also kind of okay, because sometimes we have this judgmental, self-judgmental feeling of like, I never have good thoughts, and I don't want to offer all these lousy thoughts to Buddha. But in that case, it might be nice to offer like, you know, Buddha is like so compassionate and all-embracing that she will receive these really lousy thoughts like with total love for me. Therefore, I offer them too. So we have form, feelings, perceptions, conceptions, thoughts. And the fourth aggregate is these karmic formations. So all my like karmic tendencies, all my habitual patterns, I offer to the Buddhas. Again, maybe some incentive to like work on my karmic patterns so I can offer more wholehearted gifts. And then the fifth aggregate is consciousness. So consciousness in this case means dualistic consciousness. The way it seems that there's a mind over here perceiving objects over there is what we call consciousness. And that's like, even though it's just like our ordinary way of being in the world, it's by its very nature is like dissatisfactory. It's divided. It's split in two. But Buddha is not split in two. Buddha's undivided, all-inclusive awareness. So we offer this dualistic consciousness to non-dual awareness. It's kind of like an abstract offering, but I think you can kind of get into the feeling of it. And this is kind of a nice meditation, too, on the five sense bases and the five aggregates. It's really, because making these offerings, you can't just go through a list. You have to actually experience each one, one at a time. And you can experience, just to experience it is a good exercise, too. But then you can say, okay, this is the eye faculty, this is the ear faculty, this is the nose, this is form, feeling, conceptions, and so on. And then when we're kind of in touch with our experience of that particular mental factor, then we can offer it to the Buddhas. It's the unique practice here. So that's one way of thinking about making offerings to Buddhas. And that one, these inner offerings might be hard to do with an altar, although at home you could sit in front of your altar and do that meditation. I offer my eyes to the Buddha as symbolized on this altar here. So have any thoughts or questions about this kind of unusual practice? Yes, Richard.
Anybody here read book Seven Arrows?
Yes.
We have a couple of people that did. I don't know if you can, if it's possible to go on to the internet and sort of isolate a story out of that book. That might be too much. But there's one in there about Jumping Mouse. And Jumping Mouse does something very similar to what you're talking about. Just by jumping, he notices there's a world out there, and then he starts to have the courage to go out and journey through it. And every obstacle he meets, turns out that the helpful being that will help him across requires a sacrifice of one of his senses. And it's a great story. I won't tell the rest of it, but it's almost identical, but in a beautiful storytelling way. I love that story. It's one of my favorite stories ever.
Our five senses and our five skandhas are like the most precious thing. They are our life, right? So to think of giving them away is
well, in the end, he becomes an eagle by having given away all those. The result is that when he finds out what where he's arrived, he's flying. Hmm. He's no longer a mouse. So anyway, just great book. so exact, almost parallel, you know, to another way of looking at it. Yeah.
Mm. Thanks for that. Yes, Patrick.
It's an exercise that really does then bring you from that dualistic idea of the Buddha being over there and you giving things, to really embodying the Buddha and really being more intimate.
Yeah, as I've been thinking of it as letting Buddha inhabit my five senses and my five skandhas. And you know, as is maybe obvious, that's already what's happening in reality. So it's just like accepting reality that Buddha is already running the show and already has our senses and aggregates, but because we usually don't think that way, then we can consciously make this shift. And we might think that as an exercise too, they're like, well, I know that this Buddha is not going to come and take them away and do something horrible with them, so I'm not really that afraid of giving all these things to Buddha. But in a way, if we take it really seriously, it might be a little bit scary, because we don't know exactly what Buddha will do. If we really give like complete control of like my idea of what I'm going to do with these senses and aggregates, give that completely to Buddha, who knows what will happen, really. So if we take it seriously, it's a little risky. Yes.
So you've been practicing this practice?
Yeah.
So what has happened? What has Buddha done with you?
I noticed when I practice it sincerely that afterwards I feel like much happier. There's a real kind of like lightness and joy that comes from it. Interestingly. So it actually really does have an effect.
Is there ever a struggle where your like ego self doesn't want to give something to Buddha and prefers to keep it in its little hamster cage?
I think especially the negative stuff is hard. Like I mentioned, you know, I feel like, well, I feel kind of tense now, and like this feeling is not very worthy of Buddha. I think those are the harder ones for me. Like, I better make it a good one before offering to Buddha, but to be able to offer, you know, even like an angry thought, is anger and craving are part of the five skandhas too, right? So, all to be able to offer that unreservedly. I mean, like, this is what's happening now, Buddha. You take it. I'm not going to wait till later to improve it and like kind of like hold this one back from you, Buddha. So maybe you won't see it and you'll only see the good stuff, because part of the thing is Buddha is omniscient, right? So Buddha like sees all of it. We can't ever hide anything from Buddha. So in that way, it's like, you know, take all of it, and may this giving of these of grasping and aversion and so on, may giving those away to Buddha actually transform them. And that usually tends to be the case. Because it's like the negative stuff we hold on to as my own, maybe more in a way. Like we feel like, we maybe feel like self-judgmental thoughts. Those ones are like that's who I am, and that's like, no one's going to take that from me. That's my identity. And it's not worthy of giving to Buddha or anyone. So I just get to keep it. I think that's often how we feel. So that's the time to give that away. Those identification with like the kind of unworthy me, whereas it may be also hard to give away like this blissful feeling or something, but I think not as hard. We're maybe more attached to our negative feelings and mind states than we are to our positive ones, ironically. We don't think that way. We think like, I know, I'd be happy to get rid of them. But in fact, we are. If they're continuing, that means we're holding on to them. Yeah. Yes.
What's helped me recently is there's a lot of research out there that shows that dark matter is nothing more than loving kindness, because faith traditions throughout the world, healers, have been able to tap into it and then use that force to create specific solutions for specific problems. There's scientific background for that now, more and more. And that's 96% of the universe is basically loving kindness is Buddha. If we just fall back into it and breathe it in and palm it out and give it. And that's been a very helpful practice for me, both for me personally and then to pass it on.
There's some amazing stuff happening
yes,
in this world.
Yeah.
But the Buddha might actually even say it's actually 100%.
Yeah, yes, right.
It's not just the dark matter. Yeah, everything we perceive and don't perceive, everything conceivable and inconceivable, are all Buddha, which is boundless compassion and love based on no separation.
Mm-hmm.
And the scientists keep trying to prove different percentages. Yes, Jean.
It seems like you're saying that in the offering, maybe more is better. Is that where you're going?
More is better. Well, it's maybe not more in terms of like amount, but more in terms of not holding back, like this is something I'm not going to give, of something of myself I'm not going to give. So in the end, ideally, we're like continuously giving everything to Buddha, which is in a way beyond categories of more or less. So I think in terms of like physically created offerings, like are more, you know, we're adding one more flower, is that better than a smaller bouquet? I don't think so. Like Dogen points this out too, and things like just to, you know, offer one flower from a distant hillside is like a complete offering to Buddha. It doesn't have to be lavish. And yet, because the way we work as humans, we tend to think in these categories. Sometimes then it's nice to kind of like challenge our sense of holding back, to like go like over the top. and if we're doing the outward way, you know, like, oh, I can, if we're actually making offerings to a Buddha on the altar, you could say, like, I could offer, like, 100 candles or something, but that would get, like, expensive, and then we realize, oh, but actually, like, I spent more than 100 candles cost on just, like, last night's dinner or something. So then we can start to look at, well, does that mean, like, my dinner was more important than Buddha? I mean, maybe I offered my dinner to Buddha at the time, but maybe not. So I think there's that way of just like studying our mind to sometimes do these like in these outer offerings. They're nice because they like challenge our sense of rationality. That's, I think, one nice thing about hundreds of candles is they're just going to burn down to nothing. I mean, we do buy hundreds of boxes of incense here, right, and just burn through them. And I think there's something nice about it, because from a rational point of view, you could say, well, we could be donating that money to the homeless or something. But actually, from like a Buddha point of view, it's like, you know, that's a, first of all, let's keep remembering how we're offering everything to Buddha, and then may that benefit the homeless and everyone else also. It's not exactly one or the other. Let's do both. Yes?
In the garden next door, I've got four little outside altars, and there's a little dish of water, and I put a flower in each one. And what I'm noticing is, in the winter, the flowers last for about 5 days, but now they only last one day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, sometimes I don't want to have to change them. I walk past and think, I only changed them yesterday, I didn't have to change them again. And it's been a really nice practice to go, no, because I vowed to save all beings endlessly, so I can change the flowers endlessly. And it feels like a really nice physical expression of just giving, like when you talk about giving the senses, like giving time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I could just rush past.
Mm-hmm.
Just stop for a few moments and just do that thing. And it feels so good.
Yeah.
But then if I don't do it, that's okay too.
Mm-hmm.
It's not wanting to get too...
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Nettie built a little altar on the end of the fence next door here with the thought that maybe people would come by and just spontaneously make offerings there. And so, yeah, so that's another thing. Besides a home altar, that altar is particularly for, like, expressing offerings to Buddha however you want, pretty much, right? So that's available, and it's like right in the road. I notice when I'm walking up this way, I can't help but stop and bow to Buddha, and refreshing offerings is a good one to pay attention to. I confess, I'm not so good at it. I let the flowers get pretty wilty before replacing them, but it's nice to keep an eye on things like this water offering here on the altar. It gets dusty pretty quickly. You know, we could change it every day, but I'm doing it every maybe 5 days or a week. But I think if anybody ever sees it and with some dust in it or anything, or even not with dust in it, you're all welcome to just like take it and go offer it to a tree and fill it up again and re-offer it. Just kind of like, or if you see wilted flowers anywhere, Liz is so great at always finding them and checking, but you're always welcome to refresh offerings anywhere you see them. And, you know, we're talking about offerings to Buddhas, but, of course, could be a whole other talk on making offerings to sentient beings. And, There's this water jug outside by the shoe rack here that I notice it keeps getting empty, and it's nobody's responsibility in particular to fill it, and I'll just sometimes do it or somebody else will do it. And I noticed it today and it's low, and like, oh, I gotta change that water. And like, it shouldn't necessarily always have to be me. There's so many people who practice here, and I thought there's many things like this around the temple that are just, everybody assumes that somebody's in charge of it. But most things, let me tell you, nobody's in charge.
Maybe there should be a list.
There could be a list. There are various lists, you know, but there's little things. Yes.
Yeah, I find myself sometimes, you know, people will come up and make suggestions about things that should be happening here. And I'll say, oh, why don't you?
You can always do it.
Because there is this perception,
yeah,
that somebody else's,
mm-hmm,
is or should be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, the elves and the fairies.
Yeah.
Clients used to say, you know, that they think that the elves and the fairies are doing it.
And there's so many things we try to offer so wonderfully, and sometimes it gets to be too much. Like another one is those bathroom towels. Yeah, we really like made an effort to change to these cloth towels, but nobody's really technically in charge. So I think between Patrick and Shoho and me, and maybe Nettie, we try to wash them, but anybody could actually just, even secretly, just take them home one night and just wash them in your own machine and bring them back.
I think it would be great to have a list of those things as a mindfulness practice and for all of us. You know, these are things that anybody can do anytime.
Yeah.
You know? Because people do sometimes just show up and want to do something.
Mm-hmm.
That happened just the other day. Somebody came and they wanted to work.
Mm. And, yeah.
You know?
We could have a list.
Yeah,
I think lists are good, and also just kind of spontaneously noticing things is also, I think, a beautiful...
You would be in charge of making a list.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Anyone want to make a list?
You guys can start with a list, and then people could ask. If they see something that needs to be...
You guys.
You make a list? Cool. Okay.
I'll help you.
There you go. That's exactly the thing, right?
Cookie making.
Mm-hmm.
Good one.
It's actually a traditional Zen practice to do like secret deeds of goodness, and it does happen around here actually. But the classic thing in the Japanese monasteries is like, in the middle of the night, one of the monks will go and like clean all the toilets that are like outhouse toilets, like pretty gross, and just secretly so it doesn't get any credit for it, for the worst job, but everybody is benefited, or like some, you know, cleans everybody's shoes at night or something like that. And so in a way, these, you could say they're making offerings to sentient beings, but they're also making offerings to Buddhas, because sentient beings in their actual true nature are nothing but Buddhas.
One more?
Yes, one more.
I just want to share a really nice offering that we know there's this trail up in Scotts Valley called the Laudato Trail, and we used to walk it regularly, and then once we started about a couple of years ago, we noticed, or a year and a half ago, all of a sudden there were these intricately, magnificently made characters, old sort of Zen-like or Chinese-like characters with little baskets, just, and also just placed in little spots where you'd have to notice. So when you took the walk, you'd find yourself, now you're looking, because they would change sometimes too, or some really...
Like carved into the trees?
Oh, no, made these figurines that were beyond, that were done by some stunning artists who were gotten what, you know, who were just putting them out there. But not just so, you know, you have to sort of look up to the left or the right, and you notice them in a stump or something, and then transform this walk into this magical thing, and then the thought of who's doing something like this? You know, and all this work and beauty, and then just putting it out there, you know, knowing people will take it, or it'll be rather, anyway, just a nice, offering, you know.
Yeah. The world is always like that in a way, right? You can see, like, you can, and as well as making offerings, you could walk down the street seeing all the offerings that many beings have made. And even the trees and the flowers, right, are like offering themselves to Buddha already. Like, that's amazing. That inspires me to offer the flower that's already offered itself. Yeah. Yeah, and I think especially like joyful. Well, we talked about, you know, unpleasant kind of shameful feelings and experiences we can offer, but also pleasant and joyful experiences we can offer, and maybe those two kind of extremes are what we tend to like get like. Stuck in, and not so much think about the totality of everything at that time. Well, maybe there'll be some tea offered outside. We dedicate any merit arising from our gathering this evening to all sentient beings everywhere. May they all open to the joy of making offerings to Buddhas. beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.